And next, we open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine, which we do just about every week to find interesting stories about the way we live now. This week, the story of a woman who's surviving unemployment by channeling her alter ego. In real life, Washington, D.C. resident Jane Lytle is an unemployed mom on the edge. In her blog, Girl on the Brink, she is the devil may care Ann Powers, who finds escapism and comedy and a good dose of commentary in the search for a job. This week's feature was written by Elon Mui, and Jane Lytle, a.k.a. Ann Powers, joins me now in our Washington studio. Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thanks, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Now, I understand that you're temping now,
yes.
But the idea for Girl on the Brink was born sometime last winter when you were having kind of a tough time.
Right. It was last March, and I started writing in February because I felt very isolated. It was right after the holidays, and I felt depressed. And so I was looking for the poor man's therapy, which is comedy, and started to just do a big mind dump.
You were laid off.
I was late. Well, my position was eliminated. I was working in marketing for a nonprofit in Washington, D.C.
And that caused a big lifestyle change, if you don't mind my telling it. And I don't think you do because you're kind of laying it out there. Even though you and your husband are no longer together, to sort of save money, you consolidated your household again, and it's kind of an upstairs-downstairs situation.
Sort of like that. We had agreed to trade off living in the main part of the house after our divorce, which was last November, and then his contract got terminated. So he lost his job, and then 3 weeks later, I lost my job. So we have two kids, and the only way to kind of make it work was to continue living together.
So blogging, what? It's become what? Poor man's therapy these days, or poor woman's therapy these days. Well, how was Ann Powers born? How was this other identity born? Was it initially just for privacy reasons, or is it really you felt like somebody else?
A little bit of both. I felt that if I wrote under a pseudonym, then I could write my thoughts more freely.
And Ann is having more fun than you.
Ann is having a lot more fun than me. If I could be Ann all the time, I don't think I'd be here.
So does Ann actually do the things you want to do?
Yes, I
do. Fly off to Rio?
Well, she flew off to Antigua last April because she just needed a mental health break from living with her ex for so long. So she convinced her girlfriend to go to Antigua Sailing Week, and we went, and we got on some really fancy boats and had a great time.
Was this Ann or you?
Well, this was Jane.
Uh-huh.
But when I'm in an area that's unfamiliar to me, I can sort of put on the Ann persona.
Which leads to a question, and I'm not trying to be mean. Some people would say, well, what's wrong with, you know, having an alter ego that you put on? A lot of us sort of put on a face when we go into a new situation. But some other people might say, gee, that's not very helpful. I mean, because at the end of the day, you still have to do you.
Right, but it helps you get through the day because it's a way to feed your ego, because if you're not working for someone, you're not being validated, you're not respected, and this is a way to sort of achieve that feeling, and I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
But you actually did go. Right?
I actually did go. I figured that I was going to either see a therapist, which would have cost me about $1,000 for 5 sessions, or I could take about $1,000 and fly down there, and we had a blast.
Do you think you would have done that if you hadn't had Ann, your alter ego Ann, to give you the idea for encouragement?
I don't think I would have.
All right. Well, Jane, Ann, why don't you read one of your more commented upon entries?
Okay. This one's called Sex, Drugs, and the Internet. I know I'm addicted to the Internet. I took the Internet Addiction Test to prove the degree to which I can't live without my computer. I scored 61 out of a possible 100, which means I have occasional or frequent problems because of the Internet. The Internet addiction test doesn't define your problems, but I'd have to wager not having a job is one of them, combined with a lack of income and savings for my retirement. Certainly the lack of a lover scores big with me. That pretty much leaves the Internet. It doesn't have to love me back, but my Internet connection can't go dark on me, or I'd end up at the library. Do you know what happens to the poor saps who don't own a computer and have to use the library to job hunt? Their time online is clocked by an activity timer. Once the timer expires, so does their internet connection.
Yeah, you're packing a lot in there. You know what was funny, though, about that? What was interesting is that some of the comments you got to the blog were some people wanted to talk about sex. Some people wanted to talk about they also had an addiction to the internet, but other people just wanted to give you job hunting tips.
Right.
They said, oh no, see, here's the thing. You need to de-age your resume. You need to take out only the most recent, you know, job entries. I thought that was so funny.
Right.
But you've got like all these different people connecting with you on
lots of different
levels.
It gets a lot of different advice from people, and I appreciate it. And I think I've thought about most of all their comments, but keep them coming.
Jane Lytell blogs as Ann Powers at Girl on the Brink. She joined us in our Washington, D.C. studio. If you want to read the piece that we are talking about, we will have a link at our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, and look for Tell Me More.
Sounds pretty cool. Well, let's find out a bit more about how all that technology works. And for that and more, I'm joined as we are most Mondays by Omar Gayaga. He covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman in Texas. Hello, Omar. Good to talk
Hi.
To you.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Now, David just mentioned something called the building dashboard. Tell me a little bit more about the software and how close we might be to seeing something like this next door.
Well, that's made by a company called Lucid Design Group, and it's primarily designed for universities and municipal buildings. It's not really they're just now starting to kind of integrate that into homes and into pilot projects. But it is it's real-time energy consumption information put into really colorful charts. You can see kilowatt hours converted into pounds of carbon dioxide if you want to see your carbon footprint in the home. What's happening is we're starting to see some of that kind of technology integrate into home systems, and not just new homes, also existing homes.
Omar, I imagine this varies from product to product, but give us a sense of how much all this costs.
Well, traditionally, you're talking about tens of thousands of dollars, even in a medium-sized home. But what's happening in the industry is that you're seeing a lot of cheaper wireless technology start to take the place of having to tap into home wiring. You're seeing off-the-shelf components used. For instance, there's a company called Savant Systems that actually uses the Apple OS and uses Mac hardware for flat panels in the home. So instead of having these custom-built systems that have custom hardware, they're using existing hardware. You're using the iPhone or the iPod Touch as the remote control instead of a $1,000 remote control. So this stuff is coming down in price, and you're talking about from tens of thousands of dollars to maybe, you know, $5,000. The Savant Systems has a system called Protégé that's meant to be kind of a starter kit for about $5,000 for a medium home, but that's kind of where it starts. Hopefully, in the next 5-10 years, we'll see this stuff go from thousands or tens of thousands of dollars to hundreds of dollars.
If we can, let's move on to another story that you've been watching. I understand this one has some T-Mobile customers very worried right now. What's going on?
Yes, the Sidekick, a very popular mobile phone that's great for text messaging and internet. It has had a massive server failure. Now, the company that makes the Sidekick...
That's never a good sign. Massive
never.
Server failure, something you never want to hear.
You don't want to hear that on the weekend, no. Danger, the company that makes the Sidekick and is owned by Microsoft, they were having these server problems, and over the weekend, they let customers know that some of the data that they have that's stored on the cloud, stored on the internet... personal contacts, photos, things like that, may not be able to be recovered. So they were warning people, don't take the battery out, don't let the battery die, and because all that stuff may go away and not come back. And so a lot of T-Mobile Sidekick customers very upset, writing down by hand their phone number so they don't lose them. But you know, this points to an issue of as we're putting more and more of our personal information online, if there's not a good backup for it, we could lose it.
But cloud computing was supposed to be this wonderful, great new technology. What does this Sidekick failure mean for that technology?
Well, when it's done right, you have the data backed up in redundant locations. If something happens at one place, it exists somewhere else. And it sounds like in this case, it was just a matter of just bad planning. It just wasn't backed up properly. And now customers are having to suffer for that.
Finally, Omar, before I let you go, I understand that there's a big, huge tech story that you're just dying to tell me all about.
Huge. Miley Cyrus, Hannah Montana, has quit Twitter. She had 2 million followers, but she decided to give it up despite all the love. And she told everyone that was following her about it in a YouTube video.
Everything that I type and everything that I do, all those lame gossip sites take it and they make it news. I want my private life private. I'm done trying to please. I ain't living for tabloids, no. I'm living for me.
Okay, I want my private life private, but I'm going to sing about it on YouTube. Something about that just does not make sense.
When I quit Twitter, that's how I'm going to go out, is in a rap.
Step away from the keyboard.
NPR listeners, you are welcome.
Omar, it's always good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Omar Gayaga covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman and also for Alt Tech Considered. Always good to talk to you, Omar.
Have a great week. And we will be posting the Miley Cyrus video on the All Tech Considered blog, as well as the home automation stuff, at npr.org/alltech.
I'm at house phone withdrawals. I was a little obsessed, but I'm peacing out, and I'm leaving with this. Ha! Goodbye.
Bye-bye. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Now, among those 28,000 photos taken by the albatross, chances are pretty good that at least a few will sparkle. It's the new secret of millions of photo enthusiasts everywhere, people, and I count myself among them, who might otherwise be very bad photographers. The secret is taking lots of pictures, that one photo in 100 that might just be stellar. And all of us have digital photography to thank for that. But it's really two scientists we should be thanking, William Boyle and George Smith, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics this past week for developing the electronic eye that we now use in digital cameras. Digital cameras may have made decent photographers out of just about all of us, but the problem, at least according to Stanford computer science professor Mark Lavoie, is that we've only scratched the surface of what digital cameras can do. So he's working to fix it, and he's built something he calls Frankencamera. Professor Lavoie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
What's the problem with my Canon EOS that you want to fix?
There's still a lot of limitations to even the best digital camera. If you point a digital camera out a window, it's very hard for it to capture what's inside the room and what's seen out through the window at the same time. So it either loses the shadows inside the room or blows out what's outside the room, turns it white, in other words.
There's a picture that you took, and it's on our website now at npr.org, so people can go see it. And it's of a water channel with buildings on either side of it. What's the photo, and what does the Franken camera do that a normal camera can't do?
So it's a picture that I took near dawn in Zurich, Switzerland. And when I first took the picture, it was too dark on the left side. So I took a longer exposure, and then it became fine on the left side, but too bright on the right side. I can throw both of those images into Photoshop and merge them to create what's called a high dynamic range image. Mm. But I shouldn't have to throw it into Photoshop to do that. The camera should do it for me.
So you take the camera and you just snap a bunch of photographs of the same shot, and then it automatically combines them?
Well, what you actually do is just point the camera at the scene. It decides how many shots to take, how dark to make the darkest, how light to make the lightest, and then it combines them itself.
Mm-hmm. Describe this Franken camera for me. What does it look like, first of all?
Well, it's ugly, made out of parts we've ripped off of dead cameras. But the key is that it's fully programmable. We can boot it up and it runs Linux, which is the operating system that hackers prefer, and we can program it to do anything we want to.
So what kind of potential can you imagine? I mean, say, you know, you take this camera out, what might it be able to do?
One idea that computational photography researchers have come up with is to take a picture with flash and a picture without flash, combine them, and just show you that really one good shot. If you have many people taking pictures from different angles, looking at the Eiffel Tower, for example, it could construct a three-dimensional computer model that you could then fly around, or could even let you just fly around, flipping back and forth among the pictures that you've already taken.
Okay, it sounds cool. I want one. When can I get one?
That's a harder problem. At this point, we're just creating prototypes for researchers and for students in computational photography. We hope eventually to spur somebody, perhaps a traditional camera maker, to take this over themselves. That would be a fine outcome to the whole project.
There's one thing about this that concerns me a little bit, and that is there's the potential to make everybody, you know, an Annie Leibovitz or a Richard Avedon. Right? I mean, basically, you're taking the power of somebody's talent and you're just sort of handing it over to this camera, right?
Not exactly. The part that we're not automating is the part that's 9 inches behind the lens. You still have to be a good designer of photographs.
Mark Lavoie is a computer science professor and a camera buff at Stanford University. He joined us from Stanford. Professor Lavoie, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Mr. Brown is not the only one thinking along those lines. A technology startup in San Francisco hopes to deliver tailored health plans using software that combines personal medical data with information already on the web. Reporter Sarus Farivar caught up with the founder of this new company called Kios.
At a health technology conference this week in San Francisco called Health 2.0, I met up with Adam Bosworth. He's the founder of Kias. The company launched earlier this week and aims to turn the web into a nurse or doctor.
What we're doing is automating all the advice they would be giving you if they could come home with you, keep an eye on you, jawbone you, remind you, or just reassure you when the kid's fever spikes or the adult's blood sugar goes up. So we're automating, if you will, the wellness part, not the diagnosis part.
For the past few years, online services like Google Health and Microsoft Health Vault have allowed patients to keep online records of their own medical data, things like blood sugar, cholesterol, weight, and so forth. Bosworth says his company is taking it a step further by providing interpretation and treatment based on that personal data. These Kias care plans are sent to the patient online, by email, or even by Twitter or text message.
So I could just be getting a text message saying, hey, remember to do X, Y, and Z, or remember to take your medication.
You could even be sending back a text message saying, Kias walked 4 miles. And that would log that and track that against your goal of, let's say, walking 16 miles a week, that sort of thing.
Liz Bohm, a healthcare analyst with Forrester Research, says nurse hotlines have acted as that one-to-one type of connection. Now Kias and others are trying to figure out how to recreate a more individualized approach online.
And frankly, it's too early to know with Kias whether they will get it right, but they certainly have some powerhouse talent behind what they're doing.
By that, Bohm means that Bosworth has done his homework. He used to be the head of Google Health. For NPR News, I'm Cyrus Farivar in San Francisco.
Late one holiday season, Gary Vaynerchuk realized his nationally famous New Jersey wine shop had missed up a simple order of white Zinfandel for an older woman who lived 3 hours away. She wasn't a big customer. Gary's time in the busiest commercial season was precious. But when he discovered the error, Gary put a case of the wine in his trunk and drove 6 hours round trip to deliver it. Why, Gary?
Because caring is the differentiator in business.
That's our friend Gary Vaynerchuk, who joins us every now and then to talk about wine, sports, and other human spirits. He joins us now to talk about his new book, Crush It! Why Now is the Time to Cash In on Your Own Passion. Gary, of course, is the man who's turned wine green by comparing certain wines to the hindquarters of a sheep and recommending the right wine to serve with Cheerios. His Wine Library TV vlogs made Gary into a national brand name, so he can quell and kvetch about the New York Jets. Gary, thanks so much for being with us.
Scotty, thanks for having me again.
This book isn't really about wine, is it? It's about passion, though.
Yeah, it's about why I was able to build my brand, monetize it to, you know, seven figures plus, and all I did was talk about the one thing I love the most and why I know the kind of listeners you have right now love cooking, love gardening, mountain biking, parenting. And they can do the same thing because the world's changed.
Now, you think that the sluggish economy notwithstanding, that business has never been more open because social media has opened up so many routes for people.
The cost of creating your voice over the thing that you're most passionate and knowledgeable about is zero. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's crazy, Scott. I mean, you know, the fact that you can create a blog or a community for zero, you can put out videos for zero. And now, because of things like Twitter and Facebook, socialize and network, you know, kind of like working a cocktail party, build your business. Word of mouth is how all the businesses have always been built anyway. Mm-hmm. And that costs zero. Well, now it's time. Now it's no excuses. Put down the Nintendo Wii paddle. Stop watching Lost. It's time to build a brand around yourself.
What did you learn from your baseball card collection when you were a kid?
I learned a lot of things.
I mean, you'd get a pack of baseball cards with let's put it this way, with some players that, you know, weren't the most promising or most sought after. Mm-hmm. I'm going to assume a lot of them were Cubs.
And Yankees in those days. Yeah, during the bad Yankee years.
Okay, all right, Cubs and Yankees. And you figured out a way to make people want them.
Well, it's storytelling, right? So potential in athletes is always exciting. You know, so everybody wants to buy Ken Griffey Jr. and Frank Thomas. I made a big bet on a guy by the name of Kenny Lofton, who ended up becoming a pretty big star. So, you know, you've got to look in different places. You have to fish in different ponds. Right now, everybody's so focused on Twitter and Facebook. But what about Tumblr? What about Daily Booth? What about these different platforms and playing fields? They're out there.
You have a stunningly practical bit of advice for people who are interested in building a brand. You say, use the pre-dawn hours.
Scott, do you know how many people complain or are worried or not happy? A lot. you know, if you're really not happy, I just don't understand why you wouldn't get up at 6 a.m. and hustle and do a couple hours of community work, meaning Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, all that stuff, around your passion, and then go to work. You got to pay your dues, do your thing. But slowly but surely, you know, if you have eyeballs, advertisers and marketers and business people are going to come to you. Opportunity comes. Everybody says, how do you monetize? Don't worry about monetizing so quickly. Get the 100,000 listeners, get the 30,000 listeners, get the 20,000 viewers, and you will be stunned how many brands are going to want a piece of that.
We're big into some of the social media platforms.
Yeah, you guys are great.
And, you know, we hear from people who are uncomfortable with that.
Listen, I don't want anybody to do anything that they aren't good at. You know, you read the book. I scream about owning your DNA. If you're not comfortable and you don't like people and you don't want anybody to know anything, well, then this is not for you. You know, I mean, I'm not gonna convince you. But I feel like even if you're an introvert, you know, it's not something that you need to stay away from. Don't forget, you control the message. You put out what you want to put out.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, well, I don't want anybody to find out. Well, don't say it. It's not very difficult.
You're quite open in this book about declaring that you want to make enough money to one day buy the New York Jets.
I've been pretty open about that statement my whole life.
Well, but, you know, now you're in a, I think you're on a route, as a matter of fact. I have a memory that you weren't a big Mark Sanchez fan when
that is correct. Him. That is correct. I booed on draft day. Now.
And we'll explain to people. I mean, he's had a sensational rookie year with the exception of last week.
I did boo the pick prior to knowing the details of the trade. But by then, the television images and the damage has been done.
Mm. You had television images of you, right?
Of me booing, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's correct.
That, yeah. you get back to a bit of very fundamental advice.
Yeah.
Which is love your family.
I just think about everything from the basis of I'm 95 years old and I'm laying on my deathbed. Am I thinking that I wish I made more money? I want to live my life in a way that I look back and I'm proud of it. Legacy is greater than currency, and that's just kind of how I live it.
So what wine is best for serving with Cheerios?
You saw that. Yes, so recently I did a Wine Library TV where I paired wine with cereal. The great... great combo out there is Riesling with Captain Crunch. You know, if somebody's got some Captain Crunch right now, go grab a Riesling.
Gary, always a pleasure to talk to you. I hope you can come back soon.
I appreciate Scott.
Gary Vaynerchuk, his new book, Crush It, Why Now is the Time to Cash In on Your Passion.
PepsiCo recently put out an iPhone software application to promote its energy drink. The energy drink is called Amp. And the software is called Amp Up Before You Score, which is not a reference to basketball. The application is causing a stir because it gives men pickup lines to use with a variety of women and a bulletin board to brag about their conquests. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
The app has drawings of what it calls different female types. There's the aspiring actress dressed in waitress garb. The bookworm with pulled back hair and glasses. The app supposedly gives guys just the right line to win over a particular type.
Or say you need a quick primer on punk rock because she's staring holes in you and you're a little scared. We've got your back.
These free apps that promote products are kind of like the new media version of a free t-shirt. And ads that use sex appeal as a selling point aren't new.
This perhaps just went a bit over the line.
Nate Elliott follows interactive advertising for Forrester Research.
It's not like Axe saying if you use our product, you'll become irresistible to women. It's perhaps stepping over the line to this is how you take advantage of women.
It seems like an odd mistake for a company like PepsiCo. It has a woman CEO and major products like Quaker Oats and Tropicana Orange Juice that appeal to families and moms. Elliott thinks top executives just aren't used to evaluating interactive ads.
Looking at a 30-second spot is easy. Reviewing and understanding every last possible interaction with an interactive application is a lot harder.
Yesterday, Pepsi sent out a tweet. It said, "We apologize if it's in bad taste and appreciate your feedback." Many men on Twitter defended the humor of the app, and many women said they wouldn't be buying Pepsi products anytime soon. PepsiCo didn't respond to NPR's request for a comment. Analyst Elliott thinks Pepsi may leave up the app unless the outrage gets louder because the drink is meant to appeal to young men. Laura Seidel, NPR News.